And I've got I've sort of mapped out these two pages of they're not even questions, they're kind of words to start a conversation. Some of them about work, some of them about processes of making art, about these two subjects. And you know, you're a gift actually in terms of these multiple points of entry to talk about so much. What we really want to do, of course, is include you in the questions and the discussion and the comments. I've got a slightly terrifying front row here, actually, who I've warned against heckling.
Bring it on.
So we need some sense from further back. So first of all, I mean, the most obvious question for David as a starter is, instead of going a kind of sort of regular route, you've come at art, I think, through a number of different interesting experiences. And it would be great just to tell the story of maybe start, not at birth, but perhaps
at mother's day.
Sorry, yeah, no, that's important. So we'll hear about that later, but maybe starting at university and going there, because I think I think everything seems to me to relate, and it seems to be one thing leads to another.
Can everyone hear all right?
Yes.
So I didn't study art as an undergrad. I studied anthropology, but I realised after 3 years that I'd gone in with a bunch of scientists, social scientist friends, and by the time I'd left, all my friends were at the Ruskin, at the art school. And I'd had quite a conservative art education at school, by which I mean that, you know, if you couldn't draw or you couldn't do pottery, then you weren't really going to cut it as an artist. Nobody had even kind of introduced the idea of kind of conceptual art or certainly not kind of socially or politically engaged work. So it was quite a few years later that I ended up, I'd studied anthropology, I worked for a while in theatre, I worked for a while doing kind of more conventional reportage photography. In 2004 I was out in Afghanistan taking photographs. I did a piece in 2006 on conscientious objectors during the Israel-Lebanon war, and a piece on orangutans in Borneo. And I was doing that kind of more conventional reportage and taking photographs and writing a little bit. And that became a kind of an entry point into when I then went to the Slade to do my MA. Kind of photography was my medium, for want of a better term. And then that's sort of been a slow process of kind of deconstructing that medium to the point where I probably don't even take photographs anymore, very rarely. I went through a period of doing kind of, I guess, what one would call conceptual photography, taking photographs of absences. I mean, if you look at the work downstairs, the profiles piece, that's a kind of classic example of, for me, a piece that's about the failure of photography and these gaps in the photographic record. I started kind of working with archives a lot, and then more recently I've been working in this kind of large-scale public performance, mainly because, I mean, part of it is to do with the fact that I think that there's a little bit of... If you're making work which purports at least to be in some way socially or politically engaged, then I think it's slightly hypocritical to only be working in a gallery context and to only be making work for a kind of contemporary art audience. So it was a kind of partly a conscious decision to try and take the work outside of the gallery and make work. And it's been very rewarding. You know, I moved to New York 3 years ago, and since then I've kind of met lawyers from the Center for Constitutional Rights and the American Civil Liberties Union, and they were kind of active participants in a lot of the work. And so it's kind of, and I've learned a lot about law, and I've kind of, I feel like it's engaged. It's a lot more rewarding, and hopefully it feels more like a more appropriate kind of audience to take the work to than purely kind of contemporary art in a kind of contemporary art context, and so that's very much what I'm doing at the moment, and all the work in this exhibition is kind of the culmination of some of it is work that I did on I did two residencies when I was in the US. One was an art and law residency, which was pretty much what it sounds like. It was a group of curators and writers and artists who are interested in the overlap between legislative issues in contemporary art. And the other one was a residency with the Whitney, which was also a very politically kind of geared up, it's kind of a neo-Marxist boot camp. And those two were kind of galvanized my, they kind of focused a lot of my interests. And so some of the work here was made on those residencies, some of it is totally new work, and some of the other ones are older pieces from, you know, towards the end of my time at the Slade. But they all relate to kind of the post 9/11 political landscape, and ways of trying to kind of tease out moments, sometimes quite absurd moments, in the kind of bureaucracy that reveal the absurdity of those kind of political and bureaucratic structures.
Was there a moment when you thought, actually, what I'm doing in terms of either performance or photojournalism or whatever is not satisfying in a way that perhaps art will be, and therefore I'll go to Slate? Was it a kind of moment, or was it a...
Definitely.
How did that...
Yeah, no, I realised straight away that, you know, making, you know, trying to package stories in a way that would appeal to a news desk, to a picture editor, was not for me. And I kind of wanted to try and say something more than just documenting, even though I have immense respect for, you know, a lot of people like Philip Jones Griffiths and Don McCullen. These great kind of war photographers were, in a way, the people when I was much younger who really inspired me and who made me kind of, who took me in this direction. But I knew that wasn't what I wanted to do, to be doing a kind of a straightforward representational, to be representing things in a straightforward way. It was more about kind of what doesn't get shown. My major interest in a lot of this work and even the kind of less political work that preceded it was in showing what doesn't get seen. And that's not really going to work in a newspaper.
Yeah, and I thought that was what was interesting about one of your early pieces, which is not here, called Confessions, which was, in a sense, very personal, but was already about what people kept quiet, as well as what was told or mediated on their behalf.
Yeah.
Maybe you could just say something about that, because I think it seems like such a step into a wider, more public world where there are also very personal stories being told.
Yeah. And strangely, it was the last kind of figurative series that I did, not counting that because I didn't actually draw them. But it was a series called Confessions that I did from about sort of 2007 to 2009. It was a very simple idea. I would leave people alone in a room facing a camera, a stills camera, without any audio equipment, and I'd ask them to reveal something that they'd never, for whatever reason, felt able to disclose previously. And whenever they were ready, they would open the shutter, and then 5, 10, 20 minutes later, whenever they were finished, they would close the shutter again, so that the photograph's exposure was determined by the length of time the subject chose to speak. It was the form determining the content, in a way. And then towards the end of that series, I did one with a soldier who'd just come back from Iraq, which was called Unknown Soldier, and I did one for the Photographer's Gallery, which was a commission with a North Korean refugee who wasn't allowed. And in all of these, as you can imagine, they're long exposures, so they're very blurry. And so in a way, it was a natural process of doing what, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s, you know, that Gerry Adams was never allowed to be seen, and so the BBC would always be forced to kind of, like, you know, to pixelate his face. And this was, in a way, a kind of a natural process of obscuring the identity, which in certain cases, certainly with the North Korean, was an absolute necessity because his family was still back in North Korea. And then after that, that's when I kind of... Those were the last sort of semi-figurative works that I did. And then, in a way, all the work subsequently became about... a lot of it became about people, gaps in the photographic record, people for whom we have no... images. And that certainly applies to the work downstairs.
I'm also interested in the process of looking at what's not shown. There's also quite a lot of text that you use.
Yeah.
And some of it I know this is very bad, but it's quite funny. This tweet, CIA tweet, we can neither confirm nor deny. But also a lot of it is really not very funny at all. That's not very funny either. But the relationship, the text is clearly very important to you, both in terms of work that we have around us, but also I think what you've written in here adds so much to this work as well, in terms of the storytelling and the background and so on. So can you talk a little bit about what you decide, I don't know whether it's even possible to, but what you decide to include and what you exclude?
Yeah, sure. I'd never really anticipating becoming a text artist, like, you know, in the way that sort of someone like Fiona Banner or Jenny Holzer is. But I found myself very drawn to the language of the law, and the kind of mismatch in language between legislative language, which is ostensibly about precision, and, for want of a better term, poetic or creative language, which is all about slippage and creating gaps, generating meaning in the gaps, ambiguity, and when those two kind of rub noses with each other. And so a classic example would be with the skywriting piece that I did on Memorial Day in last year. It was this letter that I came across. The ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, was petitioning the CIA and various other, the Department of Defense and the State Department, to release information on the covert drone program. And they were filing petitions under the Freedom of Information Act. And they were getting the standardized rejection letter, which is known as the Glomar response. It's called the Glomar response because it's named after a boat that was built by Howard Hughes for the CIA during the Cold War, that was supposed to retrieve a Russian nuclear submarine. And they were doing it on the side. And so they masked the boat as being something out, you know, like a fishing boat. And some journalists got wind of it, and they asked the CIA if this boat was in fact being used to retrieve a Russian submarine. And they came up with this response: the CIA can neither confirm nor deny the existence or non-existence. And that's been used subsequently and has become known as the Glomar response. It was used in relation to the images, the unpublished images after Abu Ghraib, and it's been used most famously in relation to the drone program. And so I became really interested in this phrase: we can neither confirm nor deny the existence or non-existence of any records responsive to your request. And for me, what it did was it took legislative precision and it kind of spun it into some weird esoteric existential rhetoric that could be a theological proposition or could be, you know, it just seemed like a line out of Kafka. And so what I did, it was just a very simple process of recontextualizing this line, taking it out of a legal document and putting it in the sky. And it seemed so ethereal and it seemed so kind of theological. And so I took skywriting, which is traditionally it's a form of advertising in the US. It's not very common in Britain, but they use it along the beaches in the summer. You know, Joey's garage sale, will you marry me? You know, happy 4th of July. And I just wanted to take that one phrase, existence or non-existence, and place it in the air and let the smoke dissipate and let people make of it what they will, and slowly kind of, obviously people who are aware of the legislation, or who are aware of the litigation rather, would probably recognise it, and certainly the ACLU, when they were tweeting it, were kind of helping to make that connection. But I also wanted people to kind of ask the very simple question, what does this mean? Because in a way, that's the question that the American people really need to be asking the CIA. What does this mean, as any kind of a legal response? And then similarly, the second performance I did, which was the aeroplane banner around the Statue of Liberty, it's just this phrase, the shadow of a doubt, which is, again, it's a legal term. It's an impossible burden of proof. It's a jurisprudential ideal that can never be attained. We ask juries to convict or acquit based on proving something beyond a reasonable doubt, because it's all but impossible to ever prove anything beyond the shadow of a doubt. And so this aeroplane just circled. I asked them to circle round and round the torch of the Statue of Liberty with this phrase, the shadow of a doubt. And so a lot of the work is kind of led by these turns of phrase, or a set of words which kind of I feel kind of can be open by recontextualizing them. It opens up a whole set of other questions.
And also, I think the irony is, you know, as Steve McQueen's piece did as well, about circling around the Statue of Liberty and posing questions in a different sort of way about really what it does represent and
Well, it's this, yeah, it's symbolically that you know, the statue and the, that I forget the Latin term, but the tabula, not tabula rasa, but, you know, they're symbols of transparency and equality under the law.
So did you, I mean, whilst we're talking about these pieces, did you prompt the sort of social media response to it, and how did you collect it, and did you try and control it in any sort of
way? I was really naive, to be honest. When I did the first piece, which was the skywriting, I went to the top of the Empire State Building with a photographer, and I really thought that taking the photograph from the top of the building of the writing over the Manhattan skyline was going to be the work. And I realised very quickly, because I wasn't really, I wasn't very au fait with social media, to my embarrassment. I think I had a Facebook account, but no Twitter, no Instagram. And very quickly I got calls from people saying, are you on Twitter, are you on Instagram, are you watching the responses? And of course people were photographing from around the city, because it was visible for, you know, for miles from Brooklyn to Queens to Staten Island. And they were uploading it to Instagram, and they were writing comments. And it was kind of going semi-viral. And I suddenly realised, of course, that my photograph was almost irrelevant, and that the real value, that the work was in everybody else's photographs, which in a way also spoke to me about, having come from a background in photography, it spoke to me about what photography is now, the direction that it's going, or where, you know, where, how, you know, in terms of its meaningfulness now. And so by the time I did the second one, I'd learned how to use Twitter and Instagram and everything, and I'd realised that the social media element was a very important part of the work. And that was kind of, in a way, validated by Stephen Fry had picked up the original skywriting and had very sweetly written a tweet that said, Franz Kafka, you should be living now. And as a result of that, it went to his 7 million views or whatever it was. And then about 5 or 6 days after the skywriting, the CIA's PR department officially joined Twitter with their inaugural message, we can neither confirm nor deny that this is our first tweet. And I kind of, you know, I'm not so hubristic to think that I got the CIA to join Twitter. I think they probably, you know, this was, it's a very clever move, and all the government organisations, you know, there's a kids zone on the CIA's website that you can go to for sort of under 12-year-olds, where you can learn how the CIA makes us safe, and this kind of thing. They're well plugged into that. But I also think that if you're a government spy agency and you're thinking of joining Twitter that week, and you're not looking at what's trending that week, then you're probably not doing your job properly. And so that was kind of like, that was the first time I became really aware of kind of the potential for the work to reach an audience, a political audience rather than just an artistic audience.
This exhibition sort of gets at you in all sorts of different ways, and one of them, of course, is the sound of the drone in the front room on the right, which I imagine sitting in the desk at the front would give you a sense. Now, I saw my first drone last week, which was, and I know you don't want to talk about drones.
I didn't say I don't want to talk about it. I'm happy to talk about drones. I'm
just going to touch on it.
Where did you see it?
We were literally sitting at our kitchen table, and my partner just looked out the window and said, I think that's a drone out there. And I've seen artists who've made drones, but I haven't, and I've seen
them. You're talking
drones.
About a little remote control one or a big military
one? Big
one. Right.
Like, I don't know whether it was military or whatever, but it was not. I mean, we live near the Arsenal, so you know, so helicopters fly around a lot during matches. And
they
so
do get used for
this
mapping.
This is like scary, because it just sort of hovered, and it was quite high, and it finally kind of went away. But the sound, there was no sound. So this sound... which actually I didn't even hear to begin with, but sort of gets into your mind and your brain quite quickly. It's a very powerful thing. So did you hear a drone? I mean,
in a way it kind of led with the language. Zanana is the Arabic term. It's that's become in Gaza. Zanana has become the slang term for drones. It's kind of Egyptian Arabic, but it's also a slang term for a persistently nagging wife. And it's an onomatic, and it's an onomatopoeic term because it sounds, the nana sounds a little bit like the because that, you know, the buzzing, because they're all propellers, they're not jets. And so I kind of began, I became interested in kind of what the persistence of this sound in areas of Waziristan or in Yemen or in Gaza must be like, and this omnipresence. And I had been researching also drone music. And these, a lot of the collaborations back in the 1960s between people like Lamont Young, you know, and the role of the drone in the Hindustani tradition, which is the tradition of classical music that goes from North India, Pakistan, and into Afghanistan. And the drone instrument is this persistent, you know, it gives you a rhythmic and a tonal constant. And so that piece is really a kind of an attempt to draw an analogue between those two things in a kind of hypnotic but also unsettling way. And of course it's in, and in the middle of the room is on the drone instrument, the tambura, which is the name for the acoustic version of the drone instrument. That's an electronic box that musicians use when they're practicing. So they'll play the sitar or they'll play the sarod over the top of that box. But it's very often played by women. And zanana is a term for... it's also a term in Urdu for the areas in a house that are the most private sectors, which are normally reserved for close family and for women. So it has all these kind of layers of meaning. And then in that room, with the sound piece, there's a very small blue... photograph overlaid with lapis lazuli, and it's a photograph of a mother at the funeral for her infant child in Kabul in 1992. It's what's called a wire photo, which is kind of pre-digital era. It's the way that the photographers would send images back to the picture desk in New York or wherever. So it has a caption along the top which tells you what you're seeing, but I've overlaid it with lapis lazuli. Lapis lazuli, as some of you may know, is the mineral used to produce the Renaissance colour ultramarine. Ultramarine, the Latin, means beyond the sea. I always thought it was because the colour is so blue that it looks like it's the blue of the sea, but it's literally beyond the sea because they could only obtain it from Afghanistan. And lapis was one of the few blues, or probably the only blue, in the Renaissance, that would hold its colour. All the other ones faded, and until they learned to synthesise things like Prussian blue, it was in great demand, but it was very difficult to obtain. And for that reason, it was reserved for painting the robes of the Virgin Mary in Christian iconographic depictions of the Pietà. So the piece is just called Pietà, but it's also kind of about. It's about the way that 20th century photojournalism very often kind of recycled a lot of Christian iconographic tropes. If you think of like W. Jean Smith's Tomoko and Her Bath, which is staged around a Pietà. If you think of a lot of Sebastian Salgado's images, you know, on crucifixions or on St. Sebastian's, there was a trend to kind of impose these Christian iconographic these tableaus onto subject matters that sometimes it was totally inappropriate for, including kind of Islamic subjects. And obviously, you know, in the Islamic tradition, you have a prohibition on anthropomorphic figurative imagery. And so, by obscuring the image and forcing the viewer to only glean something from the caption, it was kind of a nod to that as well. But obviously, you know, there's a relationship between the zanana and the way, you know, the depiction of the woman and the way that women have been depicted as, you know, the victimization, the classic kind of victimization pose. So there's a kind of an attempt at a dialogue between those two elements, between the sound piece and the lapis piece.
And I guess there's an aesthetic as well about the blue that goes through the exhibition.
I mean that was something that I hadn't really planned initially, but I slowly began to realise that there was a through line in a lot of the works. I mean, severe clear, which is the title of the skywriting piece, it's a pilot's term to describe clear blue skies and ideal flying conditions, but also ideal bombing conditions. And the skies above are blue are a line from the Etta James song that Beyoncé sings. The volume is switched off at the moment, but that Beyoncé sings at the presidential inauguration. At last the skies above are blue, my heart was wrapped up in clover the night I first met you. But it's also a reference to, if you read interviews with a lot of the people, particularly the kids in Waziristan, who live with this, with the drones flying overhead constantly, they talk about fear of going out on sunny days and blue skies because the drones don't operate during cloud cover because they can't see through the clouds. So actually, in a kind of true Orwellian dystopic sense, something, this universal symbol of beauty and innocence, the clear blue skies on a sunny day, have become actually an ominous sign of danger. There is this kind of theme of blue running through the show.
Well, it's just something kind of black as well. And the whole, you know, this sort of fierce redacted text, and then of course this work here, which is kind of beautiful and terrifying at the same moment. And for me, as an art historian by background, sort of art historical references to it as well. But it's this very tactile, sort of visceral kind of quality to it.
Well, this is probably the least political with a capital P work in the show, but it's one of those works that, for me, kind of took on another resonance when it was in the context of the rest of the work in the exhibition. It's based on a Helen Keller letter, a letter by Helen Keller that I came across a few years ago that she wrote in 1932.
How did you come across it?
I came across it through, do you know Letters of Note? It's a compilation of letters. It's correspondence from the 18th, 19th, 20th century between poets and politicians and authors that have never been published previously, and it's a wonderful kind of archive of previously unpublished letters. And this particular letter was written in 1932. It was a year after the Empire State Building had been built the year previously, 31. And Helen Keller had gone to there's a famous photograph of Helen Keller at the top of the Empire State. And she was asked by a doctor, a guy called Dr. Finley, who wrote to her and said, you know, dear Miss Keller, I hear that you went to the top of the new Empire Building, as it was called then. You describe the most extraordinary sight. How is this possible given that you're blind? And she writes back this extraordinarily lyrical letter in which she talks about the fact that realizing that the Hudson was not a river at all, but was actually the flash of a sword blade, and that the sun and moon and the stars were suburbs of New York, and she fancies buying a little bit of real estate on one of the planets, and Milton, and how, you know, God has given the blind, the unseeing, the most extraordinary alternatives. And so it's all about the difference between seeing and sight, vision, foresight, looking and seeing. But she has this one line in it where she says, to be totally honest, I was so entranced seeing that I did not think about the sight. And I became really interested in this phrase. And so that's the title of this piece. And so it's a performative piece to some extent. I basically took a sheet of gelatin silver photographic paper up to the top of the Empire State Building to the spot where Keller had stood, and exposed it to the light whilst facing south towards the World Trade Center, the newly rebuilt World Trade Center. I then took it back to England, I processed it, obviously it came out completely black because it's overexposed, and then I taught myself Braille, and I wrote her description, I embossed her description in Braille onto the photograph and framed it without glass. And I also purposely didn't press the image, so it becomes a tactile image. It's an image that's as tactile as it is invisible. And for me, it was also, you know, if you think she'd gone to the top of this building, this new skyscraper, in 1932, and the piece was made just after the World Trade Center had been rebuilt. So there's this kind of, I was kind of trying to imagine what Helen Keller's kind of could have imagined at that point, looking south across Manhattan, across the skyline, and the events that would happen, at the end of that century.
And then at the opposite end of the room is an incredibly, I mean, you can't think of a more different work, really, in a way, which are these iguanas. And I think it's an extraordinary story, but as well, as much as behind the Pieta, a very different story. And one that's perhaps a way later on of opening up to the floor a bit, because Ed Clark's here, who has also had access to Guantanamo. But of course, when you first see that, it doesn't sort of, you don't think.
Yeah, I know. I've had a few kind of, I didn't know you could draw, and I really can't. This came out of one of those initial meetings that I had with one of the lawyers at the Centre for Constitutional Rights, who is representing, is still representing some of the Gitmo detainees. And he showed me some of the pictures of the iguanas, the Cuban rock iguana, they're called, that run around the naval base. And I did a little bit of research, and he told me about this case. In 2003, 2004, there was an attorney called Tom Wilner, who was representing a group of detainees, a group of Kuwaiti detainees who were being held without charge or trial. And he was trying to persuade the Supreme Court to hear their case. And the Supreme Court was doing what they will always do, which is to say, Guantanamo is Cuban soil, it's not American soil, we have no jurisdiction, we're not going to hear the case. And he used he kind of exhausted all the usual arguments. He said, we need to reinstate habeas corpus, we need to restore America's standing in the world, and they just weren't having any of it. So finally, and I think, you know, I think a very creative move for a lawyer, a non-art, and creativity, as I think something exists in every profession. He said, well, look, Cyclura nubila is the Latin species name. It's a species of iguana that's protected under the 1973 U.S. Endangered Species Act. Whenever one of these lizards crosses the perimeter fence into the naval base at Guantanamo, it becomes subject to U.S. law. Any soldier, any sailor who runs one over in a jeep, for example, is liable to a fine of up to $10,000. So if you extend jurisdiction to the iguanas but not the detainees, then you're effectively affording more rights to lizards than people. And as a result of that, they agreed to hear the case. They then played legislative gymnastics and sent it down to the lower court, but at least they agreed to hear the case. And that was the first step in what has been a long process since in the courts. And so it's this kind of absurd moment which really kind of... it's something that runs through a lot of the work. I mean, that piece there, you know, the split screen video. It's actually drone footage of a couple kissing on a rooftop, and I'm kind of interested in taking these little moments of absurdity, these kind of like Kafka-esque moments, and using them to kind of to prize open or to reveal the kind of convoluted and contrived logic of a lot of these kind of frameworks, bureaucratic and legal frameworks. And so what I did for this piece was I contacted Janet Hamlin, who is the military-appointed courtroom sketch artist at the Guantanamo tribunals. You're not allowed to bring cameras into the courts at Guantanamo. So she does all the pictures of, for example, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or the chief prosecutor. She does them in this style, this typical legal style of pastels on brown legal paper, 19 by 23 inches. And I asked her if she'd like to do a collaboration, and I said, you know, I asked her to photograph the iguanas the next time she went to Guantanamo. And we chose some of the images, and then I commissioned her to do them in the same style that she would normally draw the defendants or the prosecutors in the courtroom, but to do these kind of strange wildlife images. And I paid her exactly the same amount of money that CNN or NBC would pay her for a courtroom sketch. And so it was a collaborative piece between us.
So as you say,
very strange story.
You know, alongside satire
as a
way of kind of revealing things. And I think, I mean, one of the things that Bernadette Buckley, who's here, who runs an MA at Goldsmiths in Art and Politics, and we're doing a research application together, and looking at the processes of research that artists use that are actually pretty distinct, I think, from any other discipline or sector. I think that's a wonderful illustration of it, really. working across disciplines and different ways of exploring something.
Yeah. I tend to work with kind of 80% research, and then the last kind of 10 or 20% is a kind of an execution, but it's gestating for a long period of time, as opposed to, you know, a lot of artists who go into the studio every day, and it's a kind of a process of a daily kind of maintaining of the practice, to use that kind of jingo. Yeah, it is a very research-based.
And is it at any points collaborative? I mean, do you explore ideas with people? Do you? I mean, yeah. What are the? How do
well,
you
the funny thing. I mean, aside from that piece, the only other time I've really collaborated was with a really good artist called Jeremy Hutchison, who I was at the Slade with, and we embarked on a collaboration based on a quote. We took a quote from Eisenhower. Which was a speech very early in, and most people know the military-industrial complex speech, but very early in his presidency, he made a kind of an overture to Khrushchev to try. He was walking in the White House lawn, and he saw a fighter jet flying overhead, and he figured out what the budget. He asked the person he was walking with, his I think it was from the Defense Department, yeah, how much one of those fighter jets cost. And then he kind of did the maths, and he tried to figure out how many schools you could build for that, how many hospitals you could build for that. And so he made this speech against the advice of a lot of his advisors, to the Russians, kind of saying, "Look, can't we stop the arms race?" And he makes a kind of one-on-one comparison with how many. So, for example, the price of one aircraft carrier could build this many hospitals. The price of 20 tanks could build this many schools. And then he says that the price of one fighter jet could build some 20 miles of concrete pavement. And of course, that was a reference to the interstate highway system, which Eisenhower was implementing in the United States, and basically pinching from the Germans, the Autobahn. And at the time, it was a kind of a utopian idea of kind of roads that will connect, you know, coast to coast across the country. Now, of course, it has a much more dystopic, you know, sound, you know, to do with pollution and environmental catastrophe and, you know, acres of concrete. But it was this strange phrase, and we kind of tied it into the land art movement in America and the work of Walter de Maria, and it became this collaboration by Skype, and Jeremy was in the UK, and I was in the US, and we had these long conversations trying to make a show, and I kept trying to bring it back to politics and war, and he kept trying to bring it away from that into something slightly stranger. And in the end, the show became about the impossibility of two people ever fully reaching the same point on the same page, ever fully seeing eye to eye. And it became about friendship and that attempt to bridge that. And so we had these strange performances, like he walked 25 miles southwest from his studio in London, I walked 25 miles northeast across the Mojave Desert from where Walter de Maria did one of his famous pieces, and we failed to meet in the middle. And we had, you know, a length of Walter de Maria's, you know, The Broken Kilometer, which is this beautiful piece in New York, of 500 sections of 2 meter brass rods, and he had 1 meter made in England, and I had 1 meter made in America, and we took them on the planes, and we dragged these perfect things for Walter de Maria, these sort of like supreme kind of spotless kind of objects. We kind of dragged through the cargo lounges of British Airways and through into the bays of the plane, and dragged them into the gallery, so they left marks along the sidewalk, and then kind of dumped them in a pile. And the whole thing was kind of, and we realized 3/4 of the way into it, that there was no way we were ever going to agree on anything. And so the most meaningful thing that was going to come out of it was this show about failure and about friendship. And I haven't collaborated since then.
Wow, maybe. at this point, I mean, I've got lots more questions and prompts, but I don't know if anybody at this point would like to make any comments or questions or... Yep, some of the bags.
I'm enjoying both conceptual and the wits and everything. I've just got curiosity about funding.
No.
Especially when you enter the realm of politics.
Yeah.
Who would support that side of it?
I'm glad you asked that, actually, because I was dying to ask that, because I've just started working sort of pretty recently, more like an artist, working freelance a lot of the time. It's quite hard.
It is very hard. And in the past, I've kind of followed the route that a lot of people do and apply to, you know, for funding from the usual kind of structures. I've been very lucky in the last year or so, because I've been working with an organisation.
I'm glad you're here.
I've been working with an organisation called Apolitical, which is based around a collection, but what they also do is that they support artists to make works that are non-commercial and which would normally struggle to find funding and to try and make them possible. And so they supported the skywriting piece and the Statue of Liberty performances. And it's been enormously facilitated, helpful. You know, they wouldn't have happened without them, in short. But it is hard. Funding structures do exist through, you know, in the States, through places like the Andy Warhol Foundation, and through England, through... England is gone. Like, you know, the HRC, the British... Everything's been stripped. It's even happened in Holland now, which traditionally had a very good state sponsorship. One of the few countries in Europe that still has good government funding is Denmark, but most of the government arts budgets have been eviscerated by kind of conservative governments pursuing a neoliberal agenda which wants to model itself on the American system. And that's all very well and good, but America has had decades of philanthropic, you know, it's got a philanthropic tradition. And so you've got huge, you know, pools of money that are swashing around and available to artists and academics. But they just don't exist in Britain. And so it's a huge gaping hole that's been left by, you know, the coalition government's decision to strip 80% of the arts budget.
But I think compounded by the fact that so much funding comes with stipulations and strings and, you know, wants impact and outcomes of a quite specific sort, which is very hard to promise or even predict, actually, when you're dealing with art and you don't want to. So I think that's the kind of... And that's why Apolitical and... You know, the Hamlin Awards and very few other funding sources, which really are, you know, which is really properly supported to supporting an artist to do what they want to do. They're very, very rare, as well as the paucity of funding.
Yeah, for sure. And of course, for established artists, of course, you have organisations like Art Angel here and Creative Time in America. But for people who are kind of coming up with slightly more off the wall ideas, or perhaps not as well established, it is very, very hard. So thank you.
So do people try and commission you? I mean, do you get invited to address something, or is that not particularly happened?
Maybe I'm trying to think. I've been commissioned. I mean, like the piece that I did the North Korean refugee was commissioned by the Photographers Gallery as part of their the World in London, I think it was called, during the Olympics. I mean, there have been times, but they're few and far between, and they don't tend to be... most of these ideas are not things that people are going to think of, you know, except for you. You know, if you're making the work, nobody's going to come to you and say, have you ever thought about taking an aeroplane around the Statue of Liberty or doing some skywriting? So you really have to go and kind of sell the idea in a way. I'm curious what people thought of... I missed it, but there were two big public pieces. One, the... both of them coinciding with the First World War commemorations, the beams of light, which I saw from a distance and looked very beautiful, but also kind of reminded me a lot of what we have in New York every year on September 11th, which is two beams of light that come out of the footprints of the World Trade Center, and then the huge piece, you know, poppy installation, which has been seen. I mean, I've kind of read some of the reviews, and like it got absolutely eviscerated in The Guardian, and then has been hailed as one of the greatest installations by a lot of the other press. But both of these chimed with the kind of ideologically, they kind of chimed with government or arts or culture ministry kind of policy. They weren't challenging it. And actually, the criticism in The Guardian, and I'm not sure that it was, I'm not sure if I agree with it, but it was that, you know, this was kind of romanticising war. This was not an anti-war piece. This was a spectacle that kind of, yeah, basically romanticised it. And so I'm wondering, you know, I mean, obviously it's easier to, you know, sometimes easier to, I don't know, I'm just interested in that as a question mark, you know, making work that chimes with government policy or the kind of the mainstream ideology versus work that really kind of challenges that. But how difficult the two are to get funded in perspective to each other.
Can I just say something, sorry, just quite quickly as a point of fact on the Art Angel Commission, the Ueda piece, which was actually shown in a number of other places before it came here, and it was Art Angel who made the connection rather than the artist with World War One.
Right.
And the artist is sort of slightly ambivalent
about
that was kind of great idea and sort of publicly
interesting.
Not quite how it was kind of conceived. Sound piece, it's a kind of light piece. I interrupted you. Right.
I was commissioned to make a work in response to that, and there were so many people doing Twitter feeds and, you know, all kinds of images of it. I chose a World War One photograph of searchlights of London as a response rather than making my own work.
Right.
But I went to Ikeda's talk, the art that was organised by Art Angel. And it's interesting to think about funding in relation to work. That body, or that piece of work, was funded by the World War One Centenary Commission organisation, I can't remember what they're called, hence Art Angel attaching that kind of that narrative to the work. But he was very kind of separate, and he keeps very quiet about his work.
Yeah.
But he didn't feel that it connected. It was about funding. And he also talked about the way that he normally shows more lights, but there wasn't enough funding to show as many lights as he wanted to. But then a new narrative got overlaid to it, and in terms of how many bells were in towers in London at the time. So it's quite interesting how stories circulate around work and how funding actually changes the interpretation and nuances of work as well.
Yeah.
And also how the artist has to be quite polite and strategic in order to make work and have it shown.
Yeah. I mean, for me, like, speaking personally, I was pleased to see that Hans Hacker's proposal for the fourth plinth got accepted. Even though there's, I think it's a brilliant work except for one element, but we'll see what that is. But, you know, speaking personally, like, two of the most inspirational pieces for me were pieces that got rejected by the authorities. One was Jeremy Deller's proposal for the fourth plinth, and the other was Steve McQueen's proposal for the Royal Mail. Both of those pieces got rejected, and in a way, for me, the rejection became part of the work. And then, of course, you get an example of something like Mark Wallinger's State Britain, where the work actually does get made, and that I think is one of the few examples I can think of a work in this country anyway that really did challenge the authority of the government. I mean, that was a real embarrassment, I think, for the Blair administration. And the precision and with which it was, you know, measuring the exact point of the 1 mile exclusion zone from Parliament Square, reconstructing it with Brian Hoare, not trying to then co-opt it and make it an art project, but actually allowing it to exist as a protest in a space as kind of glorious and institutionalised and as establishment as the Duveen Galleries. I mean, that for me was like a real two fingers to the government. And a really good example of when art can actually function very effectively as a form of protest. But the other two that got rejected, you know, I think it's really...
Well, I actually sat on the commissioning group for the fourth plinth. And so Jeremy Deller's proposal came up as one of a number of proposals. I think it actually had a more interesting life for the fact that it was rejected, and then Creative Time picked it up, and it was towed
and the Imperial War
States
Museum,
and it finally went to the Imperial War Museum at where it still is. And so, you know, this, some works kind of find their own way
no, I agree,
in different
yeah.
forms and so on. And actually, there had been another piece, well, anyway, it's slightly going off the point, but there was another piece that Sarah Lucas had proposed to the Horse Print commissioning group, which was a car from the East End that had bird shit all over it and so on, and wanted to put it on the. A car. A sort of, you know, kind of cronky old car that we all drive kind of thing. So anyway, that was just a bit of an aside. But I think, you know, that all the unrealised projects that there are, just like sometimes it just seems criminal that they're not that they don't have funding or support or kind of whatever in a lot of cases.
I mean, I think Creative Time, credit to them, I think they take on a lot of projects which are, I mean, the work of, you know, Trevor Paglen is extremely confrontational in terms of, you know, what the NSA is doing. I mean, he's, you know, he's an academic trained in geography, and his work is not just, he's not just making artistic responses, he's actually documenting the rendition flights that the CIA flies. The work of the big installation by Kara Walker in Brooklyn. I mean, that was, I mean, it got criticised, but, you know, I think that was, that's actually a weird example, because I feel almost like the political discourse got flattened out on that, and what should have been a piece, or was a piece, about kind of stereotyped depictions of female, particularly black female imagery, kind of got turned into something a little bit more kind of, you know, the ubiquitous selfie of me against, you know, the big white sugar breast or something. But Creative Time knew what they were doing when they took it on, and I think they took it on with the right intentions. And so it's good to see, it's good to see that kind of work that is confrontational being supported. But with the First World War commemoration ones, I couldn't help reading it. You know, I've been away from England for a while. I come back, and there was Boris, and there was David Cameron, and there was, you know, the Queen and the Prince William, and everyone kind of doing the rounds, and it was a kind of, it was an extraordinary piece, but it struck me very hard. Like, that was a classic example of, like, the mainstream, the establishment recuperating what could have been a kind of political protest, and in the same way, in a way that the CIA kind of did. You know, they said everybody, all the major organisations, all the major news outlets, CNN, NBC, ABC, all of them, even the BBC, except The Guardian and the New York Review of Books, reported the CIA joining Twitter along the lines of, ha ha ha, isn't it funny, who'd have guessed the CIA has a sense of humour? And it was all this anecdotal reporting. And then what The Guardian did was that they repeated the New York Review of Books basically republished all the torture memos, and The Guardian made the point that that was the only news outlet that that actually maintained some level of kind of critique over what everybody else was just taking as a kind of an anecdotal, kind of funny, kind of piece of news story. But when you see authority kind of co-opting and reappropriating and recuperating the political discourse that is the political critique that is out there so effectively, so seamlessly, so in such a kind of glib way, it's frightening. And I wondered a little bit to what extent that was happening in Britain with those performance, those installations.
And then one of the poppies was caught being sold on eBay.
Yeah, I saw that.
£150 or something. It's like, oh my God, there's a sacred material that's going.
And it was, you know who it was? It was like, Nigel Farage. Yeah. And he said, I don't see, you know, I'm an entrepreneur. I don't see any reason why I shouldn't be allowed to sell for a profit. It was like, you know, the extraordinary kind of tone deaf. It was amazing. Yeah.
And you have a.
I was wondering, there's so much injustice around politics. How do you prioritize the next project?
There's so much injustice.
Like, you're trying to point out the loophole
Yeah, well, my mother's trying to get me to do a piece on the culling of wolves in Minnesota.
Yeah.
It's a hard one. I mean, a lot of... I think like a lot of artists... I mean, some artists like to make the same work for many years, many decades. I'm not one of those people. But at the same time, like, I've kind of committed to researching and making work around a particular subject matter, which is kind of the way that war is depicted, particularly changes in the language and the legal structures post 9/11, and the differences between the way that Vietnam was reported versus the way that the first Gulf War and now is reported. And that's a kind of... So I don't want to kind of like... I'm committed to that for the time being. But I think going back to the other through line, it's also about, you know, it's about what doesn't get depicted. So that could be, you know, censorship or self-censorship by the media in certain contexts. But that will probably kind of lead the way in terms of picking the next subject matter. It will be something to do with the seen and the unseen. I don't know if it will be about wolves, but... But yeah, it's a good question because of course there are so many.
You have a sort of fundamental ideology. Your work seems very moral to me, rather than
very moral.
Engaged in politics on the basis of what's right.
I've never had a problem. Some people find the idea of artists making work that's in some way didactic, kind of totally... Didactic's become a kind of a dirty word, and they find that totally anathema, and that the work should always be kind of... And I agree up to a certain extent. Like, I'm not interested in making purely polemical work to me, that's agitprop. And of course I take a position, and I'm not afraid to take a position. I actually think, you know, I think artists have always taken positions, whether it's Goya or Picasso's Guernica, or, you know, artists have historically taken positions. And I don't subscribe to the idea that somehow the artist has to maintain kind of political neutrality. On the other hand, my interest really is teasing out things that already exist there and opening up spaces for reflection and asking questions and letting people... Yeah, you have to have a basis on which you do it. Of course, I mean, I think we all do, even people who claim that they don't. War is bad. I don't know. I kind of avoid those conversations because they tend to flatten the work out a lot. It becomes a kind of thing of, you know, you start getting into things of like, well, we need to balance, you know, security with surveillance and civil liberties with, you know, and freedom with state. And it's kind of, we all know that, and that's not telling anybody anything they don't already know. So it's more about kind of specifics. A lot of the work is about honing in on a very, very specific wording or a very, very specific, you know, piece of legislation or a very specific piece of military hardware or something, and kind of trying to open that up and raise certain questions that don't get addressed in other formats, for example, in mainstream media or in academic discourse, or, you know, and I think that's where visual arts, contemporary arts, kind of play a role, is in kind of asking slightly stranger or more layered questions about the way we view these things. What was that?
I think that's very important.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. But so I would certainly hope, I would certainly try not to kind of ram my own ideology down people's throats, but I'd be lying, of course, and it's plain, you know, it's obvious to see, you know,
you
that I have
about
a position.
Right and wrong all the time, didn't you?
Did I talk about right and wrong a lot?
You did, really, actually.
Wait, in what context? When was I doing that? I'm sure you're right.
Things that are wrong, you want to illustrate them, to fix on them.
Did I ever use those words, though?
No.
No.
Yeah. When I say talk, I mean...
Talked around. Yeah. Yeah.
No, I think, you know, ambiguity and nuance and bringing out paradoxes and questions and so on is even more important than it ever was, in a way, because it's, you know, the... I wasn't going to talk about Charlie Hebdo, and I'm not going to.
No, you can't.
Just to say it is kind of pushing people into... particular positions, and that's really unfortunate. And I think that's one of the things that art can do, is sort of bring those things maybe a bit nearer each other and as a way of sort of exploring them. So
I think what's really interesting about Charlie Hebdo is, you know, at the mass rallies, they were saying "Merci la police." At the same time, on the other side of the Atlantic, you know, the last protest I went up following the deaths of Eric Garner and Michael Brown was hi ho, these racist cops have got to go. The NYPD at the moment are villains, and it's got such a boiling point that, you know, they're turning their backs on Mayor de Blasio because he showed some solidarity with, quite rightly, with Eric Garner, who was strangled on Staten Island. Rewind 10 years before that, and the NYPD, just like the fire brigade, were the heroes of September 11th. And so the way the public's attitude vacillates in relation to either the police or the security services, I think, is really revealing. That, for me, kind of that really struck me post Charlie Hebdo. And then I'm sure it will turn out, you know, I know that talking to my cousin who lives in, you know, in Paris, you know, the French police, I think I had a conversation with her maybe 6 or 7 years ago, the CRS, which is the kind of riot police in Paris, you know, loathed, absolutely loathed by the youth. And then now we see the complete opposite, you know, sort of a heroic outpouring.
I think what's interesting about Charlie Hebdo is it, in a sense, is kind of the flavour of our time, the zeitgeist of our time, that in defence of free speech, we are now having the grasp of the most repressive anti-civil liberties. And it's being done because we are defending free speech. I mean, it's kind of confusion.
But that's what you're talking about, Cameron. David Cameron's
whole
thing. You're talking about David Cameron's response saying we're going to need to bring in tougher legislation. Yeah.
How do we oppose that? Because you're being told this is defending free speech. This is for civil liberties. It's exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
That kind of characterises what's going on with a lot of other issues at the moment.
Mm. Yeah.
The economy, for example. We have to save the banks, therefore you have to give us all your money, and you have to how do you attack that? How do you oppose that? How do you activate against that kind of confusion and mixed message?
Yeah.
Art? No.
It's not.
I think we're getting nameless very far.
Yeah.
I've been following your research for quite a while, and one of the things I think is quite interesting is a lot of what's culminated in this show, and I appreciate it's a combination of a long period of work with some recent work. One of the things I find interesting, and a lot of what you touch on is genuinely scary, and a lot of things I've been raised in this room are scary, but something that I haven't noticed come up yet, maybe it will, maybe it's the next project, but I don't know, people were talking about earlier, but the NSA and the idea of surveillance and technology doesn't seem to feature very much. You mentioned drones and CIA, and clearly it's a very hot topic. I don't find drones scary. Nothing like scary is technology. You can see a drone. You can hear it just about.
You can't see a drone.
Okay, within reason. I mean, like, it's still visually present.
I mean, when they're flying at their normal altitude, yeah.
Okay, fair enough. What I mean is that it's still a physical thing.
Yeah.
One of the things that seems to be coming up more and more, a friend of mine works with he's a reporter and is making a lot of technology and patient privacy. And one of the things that's becoming increasingly weird is that I'm starting to see this actually in, I'm trying to think of the TV series, but there's a kind of trash TV series now, Person of Interest.
Uh-huh.
It's awful, but watch it for like 5 minutes because it's parodying something that's clearly going on. And the fact that it's in a TV series, you know, you think, well, okay, by the time it's in common media, it must be almost accepted.
Yeah.
The idea that you can hack almost anything, that, you know, we're all carrying a mobile phone with a camera on both sides of it now, probably an iPad as well, probably something on a Mac as well. Why are we worrying about CCTV? We have it in our home, we have it in our hand.
No, that's been a really kind of nefarious kind of way. You know, all the dystopic visions of, like, literary kind of visions were always about kind of the authorities imposing CCTV surveillance. And actually, one of the most interesting... I did a talk with Anthony Romero, who's the director of the ACLU, and he was... You know, one of the things that came up was the fact that the willingness with which we brought all these gadgets into our own home. I mean, he took my iPhone, he said, here, look into here, he went into settings, and he went into there, and he said, that's where you've been. That's every single street corner you've been on for the last, you know, 3 months or whatever. Similarly, the way that cameras, you know, the cameras on your laptop... can be switched on remotely without the red light going on, so you can actually be videoed while you're unaware that you're being videoed.
I think that's something else really specific to Mac.
Specific to Mac?
Yeah, no, I'm not being good.
Yeah.
Actually, there was an article today that I read. Snowden had written something about iPhones. Something, I forgot the name of the chip or whatever.
Yeah.
It's only an iPhone.
Yeah.
It can always be tracked down.
Good old Steve Jobs. Yeah. But I mean, I do find drones terrifying. I find them terrifying. They're not for me, but, you know, I mean, like, there was, I don't know if you saw, but Reprieve came out with some data recently. They reckoned that 76 children had been killed just in targeting Ayman Zawahiri alone. That in targeting 41 so-called Al-Qaeda operatives, 1,471, I think it was, civilians had been killed. Obviously, they don't affect. I mean, there's the case of Anwar al-Awlaki, who was an al-Qaeda operative, but was also a US citizen. He was killed in the Yemen. Obama said that, you know, he had no qualms about that because he was an al-Qaeda operative. But what got swept under the carpet was that his 16-year-old son and his 17-year-old cousin, who were also full US citizens, were also assassinated subsequently after they'd already got the father. That the CIA has changed the way that they count civilians. So now any male of fighting age between the... it's like 16 to 50, within proximity of a strike zone is defined as an insurgent unless proved...
Those classifications will change depending on the nature of the target. So depending on the nature of the target, the distance around that target will clarify who is counted as a combatant or not. So, and also the point at which the explosion will take place also has rings of consequence, which have meaning as to who is an enemy combatant or not. So the rings of collateral damage also qualify who is counted as extraordinarily detailed kind of bureaucratic processes which are gone through to kind of account for the correct way of killing someone, but actually all does actually depend on the importance of the target on the ground as to who they are prepared to clarify and count as acceptable damage or not.
But then what happens when, like, the whole issue of signature strikes? For those who don't know, it's the shift away from targeting individuals based on identifying who they are and towards targeting individuals based on patterns of so-called suspicious behaviour. So if you target somebody who seems to be suspicious but the US government has no idea who they actually are, then how does that affect
the signature strikes? Signature strikes are generally run by the CIA, so there's virtually no accountability for those whatsoever, so they can basically do it. It's the targeted strikes that have the much more detailed bureaucratic process of accountability.
The ones that are run by the...
of what is and what is not a target and what is acceptable damage and how far that damage goes.
Right.
Signature strikes are much less accountable.
Yeah.
Virtually nothing really hard and fast.
You're talking about the ones that are run by the Air Force as opposed to the CIA. They have the greater degree of accountability.
There are effectively two sorts of drone strike. There are signature strikes and targeted strikes.
Yeah.
Signature strikes tend to be ones which take place in areas which are not even classified as battlefields.
Mm.
That's also contested. I mean, the main difference is a targeted strike is run by the Department of Defence as a military one.
Yeah.
A signature strike is not. It's primarily run by a secret service, even though it may involve some...
But the interesting thing is we now find out that it's the Air Force who's been flying the drones for the CIA all along. So it's purely a kind... It's not actually that there are different people flying them. It's just they're wearing a CIA hat one day in one booth and they're wearing an Air Force hat in another.
You actually get more than one crew flying one drone because you get crews responsible for takeoff and crews elsewhere responsible for taking over once it's actually over the area that it's supposed to be
looking at.
But the targeted strikes have a bureaucratic process which takes you from potentially the White House to a man standing in the field.
Yeah.
There is a kind of chain of accountability.
Yeah.
Whereas signature strikes don't have that degree of accountability.
Yeah. Yeah. And to, but to go back to your point about kind of the normalisation of it, I mean, there, it's got to the point where there was a speech that Obama gave, I can't remember where it was, but he was talking about a rock band, I think, and he said, you know, my daughter's... what's his daughter's name?
Sasha and Malia.
He said, you know, Sasha and Malia are great fans, thank you. Sasha and Malia are great fans, but don't get any ideas. Guys, I have one word for you, two words for you.
Yeah.
Predator drones. You won't see it coming, but trust me. And it was like...
That's horrible.
That was like a dinner time joke, you know. So, yes, it's
yeah. I'm being a bit flippant myself, not to get drones, but I mean, is I think we're being slightly naive about all of the... And the Charlie thing is terrible, but in the scheme of what... The trajectory, I think, we could be on.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's very hard to tell, but it's just it was funny watching this TV series. Someone else put it on my household and watching it, and there's a guy saying, we used to try really hard to get this information out of people. Now they're just sticking on Facebook for
totally.
It. It's great.
Yeah.
Right.
Totally.
Yeah.
There's clearly some... My friend's... An ex-friend, which is a very bad situation to be in my bed, is a hacker. He sent me a picture of me sitting on my computer.
Yeah.
As a joke, before
yeah.
we fell out. I now have no idea.
Yeah.
But he didn't consider himself to be a particularly good hacker.
Yeah.
I dread to think. I kind of dread to think what where that's going. And it'd
yeah.
be interesting in a way. I'm just surprised in a way that art's critical function, let's say if it has one, does what you're concerned, certainly on the whole doesn't seem really sort of touched on that. At all yet, because I guess because there are more immediate things, like people being shot, killed. But I think there's a trajectory of where that might lead that's quite hard to. It's very hard to show someone because it's so normalised, so naturalised. You say people have the phone, they don't think about it.
Mm.
When someone actually sends you a picture of yourself taking your computer, it becomes very real.
Yeah.
And I guess not many people probably have that experience. So
yeah.
it just interests me. In a way that a lot of your work manages to tease out things that are a little bit more challenging, I think it's more worthy of the challenge as it were. Because
yeah.
I think it's really, very scary, to be honest.
Do you feel distance from the kind of the subjects you're dealing with? I mean, your work is very engaging, it's very clever, it's very research based, but is just that process, does that research process, does the kind of the aestheticization, do you feel a distance from the subjects you're looking at, you're dealing with? I mean, you were quite critical about the First World War memorial, but you know, your work, while it's very interesting...
No, I was just stating, I wasn't critical, I was stating the criticism that had been levelled at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a similar criticism could be levelled at your work. It's,
yeah.
not, it's not exactly scaring the horses.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, do you feel a sense of kind of remove from these unseen battlefields, these kind of experiences of war, which you are evoking and exploring through the ideas in your work, but in terms of the actual materiality, the physicality, the experience of the people directly affected and involved with those situations, that there is a remove there. I mean, are you aware of that? Do you feel that?
Of course, yeah. I'd be interested to talk to you about what works you think do scare the horses.
Because,
you know,
horses mean as well.
Well, no, I hear what you're coming from. In terms of the remove, I mean, I have made work, obviously, with, I have made work where I have been, interacting with people on a human one-to-one level. And sometimes they've been refugees, sometimes they've been soldiers, sometimes they've been lawyers, people, you know, and there's nothing, I think it's unfair to, you know, a lawyer is just as much a person as a victim in Waziristan. And so there is a proximity. I don't feel a distance to them because I try and meet as many of them and work as closely with them as I possibly can. In terms of, I mean, I'm trying to think, you know, the argument that the was it Adrian Searle? I can't remember who in The Guardian was.
Jonathan Jones.
It was Jonathan Jones,
yeah.
Who's saying what we should really have is not a pretty kind of sea of roses, of poppies. We should have, you know, a picture of blood and gore and barbed wire and twisted limbs, and, you know, and that would be the appropriate.
Didn't he also say that we should have Otto Dix is complete.
Yeah.
The visceral reaction of a man who had been in the trenches.
I have always found that people switch off when they're confronted with violent imagery. Either that, or you get into the kind of classic kind of victimization photography, where you kind of, which is a problem in and of itself. You know, the photographs of a woman starving, an emaciated child, somebody who's just been shot through the head. I think that's deeply problematic imagery in its own way. I'm not saying that it doesn't have a place, but I think that raises a lot of. So I certainly don't think that all work should be frightening the horses in that sense, if that's what you mean. I'm interested to know what you mean by frightening.
I suppose what I was getting at is, in a sense, work which challenges the institution to a certain extent. You know, I can see a lot of this work, and that's one of its strengths, don't get me wrong, is that it can be shown in conventional institutional gallery spaces, museum spaces. It's kind of its remove from the actual subject you're exploring is one of its strengths, because it can sit in those environments, those institutions are not challenged by the visceral nature of the work, the politics in the work. I think this work is, again, I think it's seen as one of its interesting strengths. It is so removed from the actual situations you're looking at and the experience of people caught up in those situations that it can fit in an institutional environment and not be a problem. Whereas other work by...
But to go back to the Wallinger, the State Britain, as an example, I mean, that sat in an institutional environment in a very conspicuous way, and I think that did frighten the horses, and that somehow wasn't a problem, or was a problem, maybe, but, so...
I mean, the Jeremy Deller example is an interesting one.
Yeah.
To what extent that, and, okay, you might have a view on this, it's kind of its material direct relation to a scene of violence and its product... being the product of a violent event in which we are deeply implicated, and deaths in which we are as a country implicated. I wonder to what extent that has now ended up in an institution, which is interesting. But when you were first engaging with it, was that, did it, its kind of material proximity to the act of violence, was that problematic when it was being assessed?
I mean, I don't want to go into the discussions that we had as part of, but what I would say from a kind of personal point of view is, and Jeremy would say the same thing, that is not an artwork. The art, if you term it such, was the discourse that he created around it, and he used it as a prompt for that.
Well, the performance which went with it, kind of taking it around.
So it's a difficult thing to talk about. I think what it has done, particularly now in the Imperial War Museum, where the trenches have been cleaned up, and I think they're probably antibacterially rubbed in the morning almost. It's kind of, it is the one object that's there, which is a body. You know, it's a twisted, horrible, foul body.
What I find interesting is to what extent it was made almost, it's almost cleansed. Made acceptable by an institution from being an object produced by this hideous thing of violence. And it became part of this kind of artistic performative thing, and that in a sense almost validated it, cleansed it, and made it acceptable in an institution like the Imperial War Museum that it possibly wouldn't have been when it was at the start of that process, the direct product of something violent.
But immediately has the word art in the words.
But you can argue that whenever something gets co-opted by an institution, it gets neutered to some extent. Yeah. I mean, I think the Steve McQueen example was, because can you imagine? So the Royal Mail argue, for those of you who don't know, Steve McQueen was proposing to put the face of every British soldier who died in Afghanistan on a commemorative stamp. His argument being, you know, we commemorate so many other kind of. That why wouldn't we commemorate people who've laid down their lives for the country? The Royal Mail argued that Steve McQueen was trying to politicise the Afghan war.
Like a
he got the permission of something like 98% of the families. They also said that it wasn't, you know, they used the same family argument, which is the same argument that the Bush administration used when they prohibited, you know, journalists from printing the photographs of the flag draped coffins. It's the families, it's out of respect. Most of the families want it. They still haven't given him a satisfactory answer. He's made the work anyway as a work, but not as a circulating stamp, you know, as circulating stamps. But can you imagine the effect that would have had? And talk about frightening the horses.
Yeah.
If every time, you know, a man in Blackpool or a woman in Dover, like, licked a stamp, it was a picture of a dead person. I mean, I think that would have been a profoundly moving and disturbing and challenging thing, and that's very, very obviously why they refused it.
Yeah.
I really, really respect that work, and in terms of the question you're asking me, I mean, certainly it's not, you know, I haven't made a work like that. I would like to. I haven't made a work like that. I've certainly consciously tried to when you're talking about institutions kind of validating and neutering the work, that's part of the reason I'm trying to take at least half of the work outside of a gallery context.
Well, that's what I was going to come on to. You
yeah.
said that very early on in.
Yeah.
And that was kind of, in a sense, where I wondered if that's what you were trying to do. Saying,
yeah, for sure.
You felt your work had to go beyond the institution.
Definitely.
Space to do something.
Definitely.
And is that what you're talking about? That kind of doing something. I mean, the social media aspect of that is very interesting.
Absolutely.
Very powerful.
Absolutely.
And that idea that this is something which was taken possession of by everybody else.
Absolutely.
Which everyone else created.
And it's a relinquishing of power by the other.
It's very
effective
and very interesting. But in a sense, are you talking about making your work more directly?
100%, yeah,
yeah,
totally. That's why I said I thought I was naive. I thought that the work was going to be the photograph that I took at the top of the Empire State and then hung on a wall. And I realised very quickly that the work was actually all the photographs that everybody else took. And the one that I took was all but irrelevant. Completely. And that's when you have the possibility of interacting with government agencies or NGOs, you know, who have nothing to do with the art world. And I think it's really important. That's not to say that the work shouldn't also exist in the gallery context sometimes. But it's really important for me now that it has a life outside of that. Definitely.
It's interesting because I think I've possibly come from the other direction, which is, you know, my work naturally has a place in outside the gallery, and for me, actually, politically, it's coming in the gallery. Yeah. So, but politically, that's really important because I think getting the experience of people who have been held as terrorism suspects, the experience of people who have been held at Guantanamo Bay, international institutions, including war museums,
yeah,
they have that they should be in those institutions.
Yeah,
in a sense, it's coming from the different direction. But
yeah,
having a, you know, an audience outside the gallery and an audience inside an institutional
yeah.
space like that is really important.
Yeah, I think the institution thing is a double-edged sword insofar as I think that when institutions don't, particularly publicly funded ones, when they don't recognise work, potentially confrontational political work, then you can argue that there's an attempt at kind of censoring or excluding work which has a kind of a level of critique to it. When they do, the argument is that it's recuperating and co-opting it and neutering the critique.
But you have to have your eye on a number of different audiences.
Yeah.
Now, very happily, there's going to be two more events. We continue this conversation, which we might not finish now. One, am I right, on the 5th of February, which
yes.
is around the subject of drones, and one on the 19th of February about Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm.
So
specifically the banned books of Guantanamo.
Okay.
So
right.
literary censorship is kind of the focus.
So this is just, you know, a continuing conversation.
And there's also two screenings.
Yeah.
There's
two
one screens. Of the new film by Tanya, I can't pronounce her last name. Norwegian director, on drones, which has actually not been released yet. It's coming out next year, but we've got an advanced screener on that. And the other is a Haroon Faroqi film from 2003 called War at a Distance,
fantastic.
Which is very rarely
yeah.
shown.
Which will be shown here.
Yeah.
Which will be shown here, yeah.
Okay. Have you got the dates for those?
Yeah.
Or?
So the screening's next Wednesday, the drone one, and then the Haroon is on the...
And then there's also Raja is doing the thing
yeah,
on the language of law.
Talking on the language, the legal language of war and peace in Israel.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
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 So look at the website.
Yeah.
So I think we should draw a really good conversation to a close, but to thank, first of all, Rachel and to everybody at Mosaic Rooms, and to say congratulations to you for for the show and for, you know, and for inducing this
thank
conversation.
You for, thank you. Yes.